This is Greg Corumbus of Radio America reporting for WorldNet Daily. My guest at this time, John Gizzi, political editor at Human Events, the National Conservative Weekly. And John, it's great to have you with us again.
It's great to be here. You're a nice break in this rainy weather today.
A little bit wet on the East Coast here on Thursday, John, but most of the members of Congress not having to deal with it because they pretty much packed up shop and left town on Wednesday, and a lot of drama playing out on the House floor as that happened, with Democrats only by one vote getting passage of the motion to adjourn, because just about every Republican, and if you look at the list of Democrats who voted against adjournment, it's basically a who's who of who's in trouble this year trying to win re-election as a Democrat. The big issue, of course, at hand, the folks against adjournment wanted a vote on extending the Bush tax cuts. What's the political fallout here for both sides?
Well, I think that they have given what could be tantamount to a silver bullet or a stake to drive in the heart of the Democratic Party this fall. And some Democrats, as you say, those who are in political trouble, sense this. Very basically, had Nancy Pelosi permitted an up or down vote on extending the tax credits, the White House would have been infuriated, but Republicans would have lost a very key issue, because in all likelihood it would pass. You know as well as I did that more than 30 House Democrats wrote the president and the speaker pleading for a vote like this. On Tuesday, I spoke to Congressman Fred Upton, a Republican from Michigan, who told me that Republicans were talking in their cloakroom about attaching a commitment to come back and vote on whether or not to extend the tax cuts to the motion for adjournment. That struck me as a perfect compromise in that it would have taken the issue off the table, pleased the Democrats, but nonetheless put all members of Congress on record on this important issue, the tax cuts being ready to expire January 1st. All of these are lost opportunities. They didn't happen, and that was by one vote. I have a funny feeling that you're going to see a lot of angers and, oh yes, a very strong brew of tea, if you get my message.
John, you were in Pennsylvania this week. That's the site of a couple of very competitive races, one for governor, one for Senate. You were especially focused in on the Senate race, where it looks as though Republicans, at least right now, have a significant edge with Pat Toomey over Joe Sestak.
Well, as the Rasmussen poll that came out the day before I arrived in Philadelphia put it, this is his biggest advantage yet over Democrat Sestak. Toomey has 49% of the vote in Rasmussen to Sestak's 41%. He's been gaining steadily since he won the primary in May. At times it was a little tight, but Toomey is running hard and pounding hard on the issue of a vote on extending tax cuts. He always adds that Joe Sestak is to the left of Obama and Pelosi, and his only criticism of them is they don't go far enough. That's resonating in an already Republican year. And while election is a month off, I'd say a lot of Republicans I talk to are cautiously optimistic about Toomey. Similarly, Attorney General Tom Corbett, the Republican, leads Democratic nominee Dan Ornato, the Allegheny County executive. Few doubt that the governorship of the Keystone State will go Republican. And in six districts for the House of Representatives now held by Democrats, both show the Republican leading.
Very quick follow-up, John. Joe Sestak was about 15 to 20 points down just a couple of weeks before his primary against Arlen Specter. Any chance he could see another surge like he did back in May?
All right. Jim Bomback, who is a Philadelphia super lawyer and a very canny political insider, told me, don't start planning Toomey swearing-in party, because Sestak, in the end, with the help of media maestro Neil Oxman, can close fast and hit hard with attack broadsides. Now, will that be enough to win in this year? With this kind of tide and national mood, I don't think so. But it will get rough, the experts say. Jim Bomback is an expert.
John, let's move to Delaware very quickly. We know that Michael Castle has decided against a write-in campaign. Some preliminary polls on the basis that he might do that suggested that he would actually take more away from the Democrat Chris Coons than the Republican nominee Christine O'Donnell. Does this mean that Christine O'Donnell just lost her best chance of winning this thing?
Well, you could say that. I know when I spoke to Joe Miller after Lisa Murkowski announced her decision to go rogue, he said no one who was going to vote for him would then turn and vote for the moderate, sore loser candidate and have to make an effort to write her name in and spell it correctly. He felt that she would take votes from the Democrat, Mr. McAdam, And likewise, you could make a case in Delaware that it would have been easier for Christine O'Donnell, a controversial candidate, to win with a plurality rather than a majority.
John, let's go overseas very briefly. We heard and saw earlier this year a changing of the guard, a conservative prime minister for the first time since the mid-90s in David Cameron. Now the Labour Party's got a new leader for their effort forward.
Well, the tabloids are calling him Red Ed. Ed Miliband, former energy secretary and campaign manager in Gordon Brown's losing bid to hold on to office, was elected leader of the Labour Party by a very thin margin, about 1% of the vote. And in so doing, he defeated, are you ready for this, his brother, David Miliband, the former foreign secretary. You could say this is almost a Shakespearean drama, but Ed Miliband is someone who is definitely from the left of the party, said it was a mistake to go into Iraq, and took sharp issue with Tony Blair on the war and other things. David Miliband was a Blair man, so the party has definitely gone to the left. I'm sure Prime Minister Cameron is not unhappy with the results.
Real quickly, John, another succession potentially in the works in North Korea. We know that Kim Jong-il has named his youngest son a general, and a lot of people see that as a precursor to him being named as the eventual successor, especially with a lot of health rumors swirling around the quote-unquote dear leader over there. How do you read all that?
Well, this is an amazing story. As the Financial Times put it, the young general, as he's being called, is not only not heard from, he's not seen. There's very few pictures of him that exist. Yet he is being put in there as a general, and his aunt, Kim Jong-il's sister, is becoming a general as well. People suggest it might be she'll function as a regent to keep the Kim dynasty in power. And interestingly, although he's in poor health, Kim Jong-il recently went to Beijing to explain the succession to President Hu and, of course, try to get more financial aid for North Korea. I think it's just a matter of time before the last Stalinist regime on Earth collapses under its own weight. And this succession, bizarre by any stretch of the imagination, might be the beginning of the last chapter in the story of the Kim family.
John, we've got to run. Thanks, as always, for your time.
As I dare the rain and dare the political slingshots of the election year, I'm John Gizzi on Capitol Hill.
John Gizzi, political editor at Human Events, the National Conservative Weekly. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America, reporting for WorldNet Daily. Thank you, sir.